You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. And joining us on Perspectives this afternoon is Denise Kiernan. Denise is the recent author of the book, The Girls of Atomic City. Fascinating book. Thank you so much again for taking the time to be with us, Denise.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be on.
Now, tell us about, as we're approaching the anniversary of when we dropped the bomb on Japan, this book, The Girls of Atomic City, it automatically caught my eye, the title. Tell us a little bit about, you were researching something else, is that correct? And you stumbled across this?
That's it, exactly. I completely tripped over this story while I was working on another project. And it was a photo that first really grabbed my attention. I was working on this other project and came across this old black and white photograph, which is actually in the book itself. There's a lovely photo well in the book. So I saw this photograph, and in it, there were all of these young women sitting on these stools in front of these giant machines that were covered with all of these dials and knobs and gauges. And I read the text that accompanied the photo, and it said, these young women, many of them recent high school graduates from rural Tennessee, helping to enrich uranium for the world's first atomic bomb, only they don't know that at the time. And I was completely floored because I was not familiar at all with this story. Now, I actually am a fan of that period of history and actually felt as though I were pretty, you know, up on that moment in history. But I started asking around because first I just thought, you know, this is a knowledge gap that I have. Everybody must know about this. But certainly I quickly found that everybody's view of it that I talked to was similar to mine in that it was about Robert Oppenheimer and Enrico Fermi and General Groves. And it was really this perspective of the decision makers and the people who were sort of in the know. And I thought, well, gosh, you know, thousands of people worked on this project, and many of them really, really young women. And I just became really obsessed about trying to find out what it looked like, the project looked like through their eyes. You know, what was it like for them? And so I began trying to track them down.
As you spoke to these women and what you told us recently about not knowing much about that, I don't think you're alone because it was probably another very well-kept secret. And I would imagine that a lot of these young ladies took this job as perhaps a challenge, an independence, being able to do stuff on their own and not really knowing what they were going to do. Is that correct?
Well, what it was, I mean, for so many of these women, and they were so young and in my mind quite adventurous, especially when you think about the moment in time in which they lived, there was also this great sense of obligation about doing something for the war and something for the war effort. And World War II, it's really hard to understand, I think, unless you live through it, how much it affected absolutely everyone in this country. Pretty much everybody knew someone who was away fighting. Many people were related to people who were away fighting. Most of my women actually, you know, had brothers who were away fighting. So the Depression, yes, was still, you know, still a recent memory. So having a good job was important. Being able to do something that helped the war effort was very important. You know, so being able, yes, being able to earn money. And for some of them, this was a very intriguing offer. A lot of these women were probably not going to go away to college. They were probably looking at a future in their hometowns, probably, you know, surrounded by the same people they'd, you know, grown up around, which is fine. But, you know, for some of them, it was definitely an opportunity to not only do something different and intriguing, but also to feel good, to make good money, have some independence, and to feel good about helping out with the war effort, too.
It's interesting when you write about the fact that it started in 1942 when Oak Ridge was being transformed into this bustling secret city of 75,000 plus people by 1945. And the fact that they were told, well, why don't you tell us, what were the workers told as far as It sounds almost like a Las Vegas commercial. You know, what stays here, what does here, happens here, stays here.
I love that. What they were told varied. It depended on the position you would be working in. But most people were told this is an important government project, and they were given lots of information about how to do their job, but not how their job fit into the rest of what was going on. And you mentioned Oak Ridge, you know, beginning its transformation. It's important to remember there were people living in the area that became Oak Ridge, but Oak Ridge as a town or a government reservation did not exist prior to 1942. So the government moved families off of the land and then broke ground in late 1942. And by mid-1943, it had grown to nearly 80,000 people using more electricity than New York City. And so to have all of this activity swarming around them 24 hours a day, it really did get people's curiosity piqued. But there was a process that they referred to as compartmentalization, and that was that means of training that was only give people just enough information so that they can do their job and do it well, and then the rest of the time you were just expected to not ask questions. So people weren't told some other story. They were just told, this is the job you're doing, this is how you do it, and don't ask about the rest of it.
Tell us what happened after you stumbled across this picture and you said you tried to track down some of these women. What was their story? Did they remember a lot of it, or was it, I mean, it's hard to, I would imagine, to forget something like this.
Exactly. It's one of those things where, and of course it varied according to the person. The first thing I checked was, you know, I wanted to make sure that, you know, Oak Ridge was still kind of a thriving place, and I found out it was. Now, it's only 2 hours from my home in North Carolina, so I just got in the car and drove over there, and I tracked down a local historian, and one of the first interviews I did was with a man in the photo that first caught my attention, and he was 101 years old, and I was amazed at how sharp his memory was. I was, you know, quite baffled by his ability to recall such incredible detail from a time that was so long ago. But it made a huge impression on the people who lived and worked there. Even those who didn't like living there still had pretty vivid memories of what went on. And so when I was in the lobby of this gentleman's assisted living facility, I ran into a woman named Colleen, who went on to be one of the main characters in my book, and we really hit it off, and I just sat down with her and kind of did what we're doing right now, just let's have a conversation, and you know, I would show them pictures, which always helps people, always helps jar people's memories, and Colleen would introduce me to somebody else who had worked there during the war, and they would, you know, tell me about a historic preservation meeting that they were going to, and so basically anybody who would give me the time, I would just sit down with them and ask them about their experiences. And for those, you know, when you're dealing with an elderly population, some people's memories are better than others. And certainly I focused on those people who really did have a really good set of memories rather than just one or two anecdotes, but people for whom that moment in history was really still quite vivid. And I was amazed at some of the things that came out. Celia, the woman I start the book with, I was talking to her about, you know, her train ride to arrive in Oak Ridge, and she didn't even know the name of the town she was going to. She was going to be told when to get off the train and then would be given more directions. And I said, you know, well, what was that like? And what do you, and she started talking about buying a new dress and where she got the dress and her shoes. And it was because that day was so unique and such a strange experience, nothing like anything she'd ever done before. There were incredibly detailed memories that she still had about that experience in her life.
as the war was drawing to a close, and of course, people weren't aware really what was going on, and then suddenly President Roosevelt passes away. President Truman says, "Here, it's all yours now," and I'm sure he was like, "Oh my gosh." What did at that point did some of the ladies start to catch on that perhaps something, or was it not till after the bomb was dropped, the first one?
For the vast majority of not just women, but people who worked on the Manhattan Project, the vast majority of them did not realize the overall purpose of the project until the first bomb ever used in, first atomic bomb ever used in combat was detonated over Hiroshima. And the way people found out really kind of varied. You know, this is not just before, you know, tweeting. This is before television. So you either found out via newspaper, word of mouth, or because you heard something on the radio. And if you were at work, you know, you were limited to what other people around you had managed to pick up. And word spread fairly quickly that there was going to be a big announcement, and it had something to do with the war. So people who could got to a radio, and it was during Truman's address that the town Oak Ridge was specifically mentioned. And this really floored people living there because in many ways they'd gotten used to secrecy. They'd sort of gotten used to not knowing. And then, you know, here their town was being mentioned in the same story about this, you know, what was really being called a new kind of weapon, and a weapon that people had not ever really seen before. And so even though they knew that what the town itself was a part of, they didn't know specifically, necessarily, what their individual roles were. So what was interesting is some things, you know, remained secret for a time for some of the people working there.
As far as talking to other people, were you able to speak, or did you travel to Los Alamos or White Sands Missile Range or Trinity Site, et cetera?
I have been to Los Alamos. I tried. There was so much to do in Oak Ridge that I really spent the vast majority of my time was spent there. I mean, you could do 10 of these books, really, if you wanted to go around to so many of these communities that have been involved in that aspect of our Defense Department. And there's so many fascinating and interesting stories and important perspectives to gather, but I really did want to go as deeply into Oak Ridge as possible. So that's where my majority of my focus was.
And, of course, as we look back now, people would say could have, you know, would have, should have, as like Don Meredith, former Dallas Cowboy quarterback, said, if ifs and buts were candy and nuts, we'd all be home for Christmas. But what about the fact that, you know, nowadays people are saying we shouldn't have dropped that bomb, we shouldn't have been working on that because the Japanese people were ready to surrender. And at that point, of course, as you said, this was a big secret, and a lot of people were being killed, and they just wanted to bring this war to an end.
What I tried to do in the book was focus on how the people in this community felt at that moment in time. And that was a challenge, but it was something I really wanted to do because, as you said, there are all of these debates and these discussions, and they're important debates and discussions, and that's fine. But what I wanted to do was really capture the experiences of people who essentially lived in two completely different worlds. They lived in a world with nuclear weapons, and they lived in a world without nuclear weapons. I personally don't know what it's like to live in a world without nuclear weapons. I've always known, you know, what the bomb is. You know, I grew up knowing about that. And I was really interested in what it was like to not have that knowledge and what it was like to be there when the world changed in many ways. And so in the book itself, what I do is really try and stay with the characters as they learned more about this experience. Because there have been many books written about you know, about the bomb and the decisions behind it. And I cite many of those in my, you know, in my endnotes, and that's all good and well. But I wanted to really stay with the experiences of the people themselves and just let them tell their story and just really kind of, as a journalist, just be an observer to that.
And that's why the title, as I mentioned, sprung out at me, The Girls of Atomic City. And the fact that you're telling it as a journalist, and of course, journalists, from my standpoint now, we're seeing very few of them now because it's more their opinion, and journalism ethics have gone out the window in some instances. But the way you write this,
I agree.
The way you write this book, you tell the story, which is what you're supposed to do as a journalist, and it's their story. You're writing it, but it's their story.
Thank you. I agree wholeheartedly, and honestly, it's in many ways it's just not my place to tell them what to think or how to react or what to do. It's just me. I'm just should be there and listen and report back to the reader. I mean, there is room within, you know, the world for other kinds of writing and reporting, but what I really, really wanted to do is what you said, just let them tell their story. Because when you're dealing with a moment in time as significant as this is, I think we owe it to ourselves to look at it from as many different points of view as possible. And so I wanted those points of view to be theirs. And so that's what I tried to do.
Denise, books, because of technology, books have changed completely. In fact, it's sad to see that very few people read nowadays. Of course, because of the social media, it has also promoted some reading with the iBooks and Kindle books and eBooks. Now, your webpage and your book is a little bit different, too, because it also has videos there. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we wanted people to really feel as though if they were curious about the book, they could go to the website, which is girlsofatomiccity.com, that they could go to the website and kind of sink into that world and get a better idea about what it might be like. So we wanted to have the map, and we had access to Ed Westcott's amazing photography, and we wanted to not only incorporate that, but also, you know, I love promoting Ed's photography whenever I can. He's 91 and just incredibly talented and happily still with us and you know, still taking pictures. And I wanted people to be able to go to the site if they were thinking, huh, well, I might be interested, but I'm not sure, and just sort of feel as though they were kind of going back in time and get a look at things and also hear me talk about my experience. So that's one of the videos that's there as well, is me talking to the reader. But we wanted it to be as rich an experience as possible.
One of the questions that I've gotten asked, and this is because when I first saw the book, I started, I guess, spreading the word like wildfire, telling you guys have to read this book. You guys got to look at this book. But when I saw these videos, I guess some of the people were wondering also, is there a documentary coming out, or is there something that you can watch that comes with a book? Anything like
that? Thank you for spreading the word, first of all. But also, yes, I am in the process right now of working on a documentary. I hope to have it finished by the time the paperback comes out in March. Maybe I shouldn't have said that out loud because now the pressure is really on. But I am in the process right now of working on a documentary. I filmed all of these interviews. Many of these women are still with us. And I think for people who've read the book, it would be really, just really interesting to get to hear their voices and see them today. And so, yes, I am working as hard as I can.
And what a great gift, what a great memory for the grandchildren and the children of these women.
Well, it's been really rewarding. I would say probably the most rewarding part of this is to get letters and emails and Facebook posts from other people, whether or not their family was in the book, but people whose parents or grandparents' memories were jarred by having seen the book. And just to get notes from family members of the people who were in the book talking about, especially those who have parents who've passed on or grandparents who've passed on, and they feel like there's a nice, you know, memory that they, of their parents and their experience. And it's very touching when I get those notes.
What about, as you mentioned, and I mentioned that you're telling their story, and on your webpage, actually, when it says a work in progress, is that yours?
Oh, a work in progress? That's me, yes. I consider myself a work in progress. I do,
okay.
Indeed.
Well, I just love those words. It's great. But I was going to ask you about the fact that we're telling a story, or you're telling a story, rather, about ordinary people like you and I. And sometimes a lot of journalists used to, and sometimes still do, get the official word, I guess, because they don't want to either do research, or it's easier to have the mayor say, we're going to raise taxes. Well, go after the person who it's going to affect and ask them, how is this going to affect you? That way it's the real person. So did you get any responses or any comments, reaction from some of the government officials or people who worked on the bomb officially?
Well, a lot of the people who worked on the bomb at higher levels are not with us anymore. I give talks to Department of, I'm giving talks to Department of Energy folks, down the line. I had some people from the existing facilities in Oak Ridge come out for my talk. I think people have been very supportive of preserving this moment in history. And I think a lot of people, you know, really, they do understand that, it's, you could argue it's the most significant event of the 20th century. And so let's hear from everybody about it. Let's not just hear from the highest echelon of scientists and decision makers. Those are very, very important stories, but they're not the only stories. So I think there's been, I feel fortunate there's been a real embracing of the idea of kind of hearing the stories of, like you said, those ordinary people. And for me, as a reader as well as a writer, just makes everything feel more accessible.
Tell us a little bit about, I'm going to kind of switch away from your book, but I want to talk a little bit, if you don't mind, about, because you're involved in a lot of things, and one of those is Nutcraft Productions. Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's actually, I would have to say, it's a, I've worked as a producer in different capacities. It is not, I have been so overwhelmed with work on this current project that I have not been able to dedicate as much time as I would like to Nutgraf. But the inspiration for the name is about the Nutgraf of a story, which is where you just kind of get
journalism,
down to,
uh-huh.
Yeah, from journalism, just get down to the, you know, where's my nut graph? You know, you hear editors say, you know, what is this about? Tell me what this is about. And it sort of speaks to that kind of clarity that that I like. And so that's where that came from.
Which young people now today refer to as texting, I guess, but it's not the same thing.
Oh, my goodness. And, a little more information than that's usually good.
Yes. As far as the book itself, and because, as you mentioned, you have a documentary in the works, and is the book available as a Kindle book, as an e-book, and an audiobook as well, or simply?
Absolutely. Well, there are a couple in print. Right now it's in hardcover, and there is a hardcover version which you can order anywhere books are sold. There is also a large print edition that can be ordered, and you might be able to pick that up in your local bookstore. If not, they can order it from you. Of course, you can order it anywhere online. It is available on Kindle. It is available on iBooks. It's available in all sorts. It's available on Nook, all sorts of ebook formats. And the audiobook is in the process. It's not available yet, but it will be. Anybody who's interested can go to either my website, denisekiernan.com, or to girlsofatomiccity.com and sign up for my mailing list. I usually, or go to my Facebook page, Denise Kiernan Author, and I try and keep people up to date when new things happen, when I'm giving signings or on various places on tour, and I will certainly let everybody know when the audiobook is available, because that's probably the question I get most often, is when is the audiobook ready? So not yet, but it is in the process of being done.
And the reason I asked you that is because that's one of the things that has really jumped up. I mean, I've always been a fan of audiobooks because I love old radio dramas, and that those are some of the classes that my producer and I teach, radio dramas. But the fact that perhaps sometimes when people like being told stories, and especially if the reader or the narrator or whoever's telling the story is really good, you have their attention. You have them focused. And today's generation, they want everything happening right now.
Sure, yes. I love audiobooks, too. I love listening to them in the car. I like just sometimes laying. Sometimes my eyes are tired at the end of a day of staring at screens, and I just want to listen to somebody. Just listen to somebody tell me a story. So, yes, I'm very excited that we are doing the audiobook, and I can't wait for it to be done, but it's not done yet.
As we're approaching the anniversary of the dropping of the bomb, the first one, of course, Hiroshima in August, 6th of August, the day before my dad's birthday, and then the next one was August 8th, was it, or 9th?
9th, okay. August 9th.
I imagine that you're pretty busy as far as speaking engagements and stuff like that.
Well, actually, I feel like I haven't stopped since March. The book came out in March, and I've been off and on the road. I was off and on the road pretty consistently for almost 3 months. I do have several book festivals I'm going to be attending in late August and in September. I'll be at the Decatur Book Festival in Atlanta, Georgia. I'll be at the National Book Festival in Washington, D.C. in September, which I'm very excited about. More so I can go see some of my favorite authors, too. I'm very excited. But and I do have some speaking engagements coming up as well. And it's been interesting, and, you know, I'm very happy I'm able to, you know, share these experiences. And I show a lot of photos, and I always run into people who had something to do with this time in history, or related to someone that had something to do with this time in history. And the conversations are always so interesting. And I really enjoy that part of this. Some writers don't, but I actually do enjoy kind of interacting with readers.
Give us again the webpage, your webpage, Denise.
Right. You can go to girlsofatomiccity.com. Or DeniseKiernan.com, DeniseKiernan.com. Or also there's information on the Facebook page, which is Facebook, and the page is Denise Kiernan Author.
Well, Denise, thank you again very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been visiting with Denise Kiernan, the author of The Girls of Atomic City. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.